But the speculations, inevitable speculations that I find most convincing have to do with, as we were talking about earlier, the propping up of the dollar on international exchange markets and the securing of the resource base in the region as a whole by establishing permanent military bases in Iraq. The U.S. would have a strategic foothold in the region that it does not have currently. I think that there's no real exit strategy from the Iraq invasion. I think that the idea is not to go in and establish an American-style democracy and get it up and running and then pull out. I don't think that's really in anyone's game plan for this adventure. The establishment of a strong military foothold in Iraq would tip the balance of geostrategic power quite dramatically. China, which is the one country in the world that is experiencing pretty dramatic industrial growth right now, has fairly limited petroleum reserves and is importing more oil each year. China is eyeing the Middle East very closely right now because in order to maintain industrial growth, China will need more and more oil imports. Europe, of course, needs oil imports. The North Sea oil, which sustained growth in Britain and Norway for the last couple of decades, North Sea oil has peaked as of 2000, 2001, and is on its inevitable decline. So Europe needs oil from somewhere. Russia is currently a net oil exporter, a big source of oil for the Eurasian continent, but Russia's oil production peaked back in 1987. So even though they've been able to export a considerable amount over the past few years, the likelihood of the maintenance of that rate of extraction is very low. So right now, the OPEC countries of the Middle East are sitting on something like three-quarters of the proven oil reserves of the planet. That means that the Middle East is the strategic pivot for the entire globe. And U.S. geopolitical strategists are seeing the inevitability of a contest for the control of Middle Eastern oil between all of these powers, Europe, Russia, China, and the United States itself. And this will be the determining geopolitical struggle of the 21st century. And I think the Wolfowitzes and the Richard Pearls and the Donald Rumsfelds are just determined to get there first with the biggest army. Stick the flag in the ground and say, okay, this is ours. That's what it's really all about.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're listening to an interview with Professor Richard Heimberg, author of The Party's Over, Oil War, and the Fate of Industrial Society. Julian Darley is the interviewer. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. We continue.
Japan, of course, has been a U.S. protectorate. We've guaranteed their access to petroleum resources from the Middle East for the last several decades, and Japan has been quite a happy partner to the U.S. in that regard. But Japan is starting to look out after its own interests as well. The post-World War II global political regime involved really Europe and Japan as major pivots for the U.S., major protectorates. And this situation worked well for all parties involved. But both Europe and Japan, especially Europe right now, but I think in coming years Japan as well, is starting to look out more for their own interests because Washington is going to be abandoning them. Washington is seeing its interest being not in the military and economic protection of Europe and Japan so much as in the military and economic protection of its resource base. And it will be seeing Europe and Japan not so much as allies, but as competitors for that resource base, just as it will be seeing, and much more so, China as a competitor for that resource base. Japan, of course, has almost no indigenous energy resources. And so Japan will be motivated much more so than the U.S. to engage in radical conservation efforts and transition to renewables. And particularly from a sort of sociological standpoint, one could say that people in nations with no resources will in fact be in a much better place in many ways than people who are living in countries that do have resources. That seems almost counterintuitive, but the reason I say that is that whatever resources still exist, particularly energy resources, also water, fresh water, are going to be in places that will be contested for, and contested for ever more vigorously as time goes on. So pity the people who live in countries that still have natural resources remaining. And I can include the people of Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Venezuela in that. Japan, simply by its lack of resources, on one hand, is in a situation where its industrial economy is deeply imperiled because, of course, it relies on imported oil overwhelmingly. But on the other hand, because it lacks indigenous resources, it's not likely to be fought over very much by other powers. So Japan's challenge in the next century is to reduce its population, reduce its per capita energy usage, and make the transition relatively undisturbed by other countries, I predict, relatively undisturbed, make the transition from its industrial growth economy presently to a sustainable low energy economy.
You were just saying at the end of your previous reply, you were talking about wars and military behavior and so forth, and I wondered what your thoughts were just briefly about this, and this kind of ties in net energy as well. You get to a situation where you need oil to fight wars for oil, and I wonder if the military planners at any stage do a little calculation and say, hang on, we're going to use more oil, killing all these people and, you know, using our machines and our stealth bombers than we'll actually get out. Do you think that's, I mean, can you speculate on that?
Well, you know, if these people were acting rationally, I think they would be doing exactly those sorts of calculations. In fact, I doubt that there's anyone in the military doing those sorts of calculations. Because if you look at the weapons systems that they're proposing having built and deploying, they're extraordinarily energy wasteful systems. I mean, there are more efficient ways of waging wars and less efficient ways, and the people in charge in the Pentagon seem to have no clue about energy efficiency. Not one brain cell in anyone's head is flashing in that direction. I think this is part of a much larger problem. It's possible to speculate that there are a few people in the Bush administration who are somewhat aware of the energy depletion, of the oil depletion issue. And the reason I say that is because Matt Simmons, whom you've also interviewed, is in touch with officials in the Bush administration, and Bush himself. And, of course, he's a crusader on this issue of natural gas, particularly, and also oil depletion. So there has to be some awareness among these people that this is a factor, that this is an issue. But on the whole, I get the impression from everything I read that their understanding of the issue is very, very dim. I think George Bush himself has very little scientific background, very little scientific training or understanding. Even someone like Dick Cheney, who's, from all accounts, a pretty intelligent man, is balancing so many other factors in his head, geopolitical strategy and economics and the dollar and national politics and getting ahead of the Democrats and so on, balancing all of these factors that the overwhelming importance of the energy issue just doesn't seem to get through. Whether it's the military or the Congress or the executive branch, I think the understanding is pretty dim. It's not a very hopeful situation in that regard.
I was very interested in Chapter 5 of your book that you made some comments about traditional politics and right and left and difficulties that both sides were having. You also mentioned that Marxists and anarchists were going to find themselves also in difficulties. So, and you also mentioned, you made the question of if the right triumphs, what would that look like? So I wondered if you could say about something about traditional politics and what some of the traditional alternatives have to offer, which I think we both agree are problematic, but I would love to hear you sort of say this. And you might want to tuck in where some of the green organizations are on this, because that kind of spreads across that.
The traditional political philosophies really try to avoid population and resource issues like the plague, and this goes for the left as well as the right. Nobody wants to present bad news or be associated with the bad news that there are limits. The right political philosophy basically says that individuals should have the freedom to accumulate resources or to gain access to resources to an unlimited degree. So if one person accumulates hundreds of billions of dollars and other people are starving, that's fine. And the reason that's fine is that it's because of individuals, talented individuals, geniuses, that society as a whole advances. You know, we only had one Beethoven, we only had one Einstein, and you know, if society were just leveled out and people had no incentive to become outstanding in their fields and to work hard, then, you know, society as a whole would languish. So that's the philosophy of the right, the resource philosophy of the right, which is for individuals to have freedom to accumulate as much as possible. Well, the political philosophy of the left is that, you know, that's basically immoral. When individuals accumulate extravagantly unequal resources or access to resources, which is what money is, it's a symbol for access to resources, then society as a whole suffers, because what happens? Well, if you have few people with lots and many people with little, then you have to have well-armed police to protect the people with the much from the rest of the people with the little, and you have to then pay for the social costs of the fact that the society as a whole is just not working because there are so many people who can't get by, who are, whatever, starving or in hospitals with diseases that could cheaply be treated or avoided, but people can't do that because they don't have the access to the resources. So the left is saying that access to resources should be more or less equal. And democracy, which is the idea that everybody should be involved in the decision-making process, is in a fundamental way a kind of leftist idea, because when everyone is together making decisions democratically, what are they going to be making decisions about? Well, allocation of resources is probably the most important area of decision-making in any society. So if you're saying that the people themselves, all of the people, are going to have access to decision-making about allocation of resources, well, that's inherently a kind of leftist idea. But neither the left nor the right is really prepared to deal with a situation in which resources become depleted. Why is that? Well, for ideological reasons, the right has adopted the view that if we leave everything to the free market, if we allow wealthy individuals to accumulate capital with no limits, then everything will work out in the end. There will be enough for everyone because it will trickle down by the wealthy accumulating and then investing that money in more productive enterprises. It will create jobs and everybody will ultimately be better off. And the left is saying, well, if we just you know, make our decisions democratically and share relatively equally the resources that we have, there will be enough for everybody. So if you get to a situation where there actually, for physical reasons, isn't enough for everybody, the kind of situation that we're approaching with oil depletion, what does that do to the arguments of both the left and the right? It makes them untenable. So if you happen to have a rightist government in power that's saying, well, it's all going to trickle down and society as a whole is going to do okay, and people see that, in fact, they're not doing better, that they're doing worse and worse because there's less to go around, well, that rightist government isn't going to be very popular for very long. But on the other hand, if you have a leftist government in power that's saying, well, if we all just share equally and make our decisions democratically, you know, there's going to be plenty for everyone, and people find that, in fact, there isn't plenty for everyone, that there are fundamental limits to population and resources, that leftist government isn't going to be popular for very long. So we're entering a period of potential political turmoil where we may see, you know, governments shifting from one extreme to the other with nobody really having the ability to address the issues, and with both sides being motivated to hide what the real issues are. Nobody is going to want to say, well, this is all the inevitable result of industrialism itself. It's the way of life that our parents and grandparents and we ourselves have adopted, a way of life based on resource extraction and growth that has produced these problems. No one's going to want to say that. You know, there are people on the left are going to want to point the finger at the rich individuals and the greedy corporations, and the people on the right are going to be pointing their finger at the leftists and foreigners and terrorists and so on, and saying, well, we just need to invest more money in police and military and intelligence gathering and so on. And none of these solutions will help the least bit. I'm afraid that political capital and economic and energy capital are going to be squandered, not in solving the problem, but in hiding the problem. So what we really need is actually a whole new form of politics, an ecological politics, a politics of reality. Now, who's talking about this? Are there political groups who are talking about this? Very few that I have seen. I think, as you said, the Marxists and most of the anarchists are pretty much avoiding the issue. There are a few people who are mostly scientists, people like Virginia Abernethy, who wrote the book Population Politics, David Pimentel, professor up in Ithaca, New York. People like that are aware of the issues, but these are scientists. They're not political leaders. It's going to take a different kind of political leader to raise these kinds of issues, and it's difficult for somebody to do that because people don't want to hear the bad news. You know, the political leaders who begin to raise these issues are not likely to get reelected, are not likely to gather people around them. You know, when I talk about this stuff to audiences, you know, people immediately say, well, can't you give us some hope? Well, I think hope is actually part of the problem. I mean, yes, we all need hope in order to keep going. I'm not putting hope down, you know, entirely, but we tend to attract ourselves to false hopes. We'd rather have a rosy picture of the future than the truth. And right now, I think what we desperately need is a big dose of reality, of the truth. And if we're going to have hope, we need to have that hope constructed out of the elements of the real picture before us, rather than being constructed out of, you know, just what sounds good or what is politically expedient or what's going to cause the stock price for my company to increase.
So that kind of moves us on to the final section. How do you think we should be preparing for the global peak in oil production as individuals and societies and one might add as groups and all kinds of levels? And I wondered if in that answer, were you considering saying something about local currencies, for instance, and something about food and agriculture, which tends to often have a lot to do with local currencies, and I got the impression that you were hinting at moving towards a more plant-based diet, or that may be just my bias. And you did say some nice things about effective versus efficient farming, which I picked up on, and I mentioned that Daniel Pauly talked about this in terms of fisheries. But so this idea of we've been tremendously damned effective, but we're very, very inefficient. So these things all seem to go with food, agriculture, and local currencies obviously have something to do with buffering from these currency turmoils that I think we both think are going to happen. So that, if you wanted to say something around that and this idea of our sort of individual and societal preparations.
Yeah, I think we need to be preparing for the energy downturn, which is right upon us. We're not talking about something 20 or 50 years from now. We're talking about something that is happening right now as we speak, particularly in North America with the soaring natural gas prices. What we need to do to prepare is on several levels. First of all, the individual and family level. We need to be becoming more self-sufficient at the most basic survival levels. We should be growing our own food. I know for people who live in apartment houses in large cities, that sounds like a tall order, and probably people in those situations are not going to be able to grow all their own food. Growing all of your own food is a lot of work. I know, because I'm an avid gardener, and it's one thing to grow a couple of tomato plants. It's another thing to grow enough calorie crops to feed oneself through a whole season or a whole year. So I know what a tall order that is. But the fact of the matter is that the food system that we have now, which is a global food system where food travels something like 1,300 miles before it reaches the plate of the average consumer, that system is imperiled. And for the purposes of our own personal and family survival, we need to be producing food ourselves. If you don't know how to garden, learn. If you have any space available, start putting it into production. Learn how to revitalize your soil. Gardening and farming are practices that require a tremendous amount of knowledge and skill that has to be developed over time. And it's not just a matter of going out to the garden shop and buying, you know, big bags of compost and artificial fertilizers and dumping it on the ground. One has to gain an appreciation of the living soil as an ecosystem and how to work with that ecosystem. Another element of personal and family survival is changing one's lifestyle so that one is not so dependent upon this continuing stream of resources imported from the global economy. And that comes down to all kinds of really, really basic things. You know, how much money are you spending every week? How many miles are you driving? How close do you live to where you work? What kind of work are you doing? How is your house heated? How well insulated? Where does the heat come from? These are all the questions that we should be asking ourselves as individuals and families. But individual survivalism is not going to be very effective, ultimately, in the energy downturn, unless we live in communities that are surviving. Because if you're just one individual with a vegetable garden and all of your neighbors are starving, guess what's going to happen to your vegetable garden? So we need to be building community solidarity, figuring out who our neighbors are and what interests we have in common with them. What's our local governance structure? You know, who's making decisions for our community? Does our community have any kind of long-term sustainability plan? Does it have some plan for food security in the event of disruption in the food supply? These are questions that could well be directed to local officials. Becoming involved in local politics could be a very important way of helping this transition. And I think the community level, in fact, is probably the most important level at which we should be working to make change. The individual level is important, and the higher levels, national and global levels, are important too. But at the global levels, it's really hard to make a difference. And at the individual level, we're really subject to whatever is going on in our local community. So the community level is, I think, the most important one to protect our local economies, protect and build our local economies from the globalizing influences of the Walmart and the McDonald's chains and so on, and building local food networks. One way to do this is by, as you mentioned, local currencies. A number of communities like Ithaca, New York, has the Ithaca Hours. There are very different kinds of community currency systems. Some of them electronic, some of them use printed forms of money. But there are a lot of advantages to the local economies, the local currencies, I should say. First of all, they encourage local economy. They encourage people to do business with other people in their community rather than seeing their money constantly being drained outward to huge multinational corporations and banks. Also, a facet of local currencies is that they're not debt-based. Unlike the dollar and other national currencies, they're not created through the making of loans with compound interest attached. So community currencies are much better able to weather extraordinary economic downturns like depressions. During the Great Depression, a number of communities that were able to survive and thrive precisely because they had local currencies that they could use and where they didn't have to rely on national currencies like the dollar. So that's important. At the national level, we should, of course, be lobbying for radical energy conservation measures. I mean, the fact that in the U.S., the administration and the Republican-controlled Congress shot down higher fuel efficiency standards for cars and trucks, I mean, that is just absurd. That is so, it's off the scale. You know, it's hard to be able to register the amount of outrage due a stupid decision like that. And, of course, that's all a result of the lobbying on the part of the petrochemical and petroleum and automotive industries. Well, we need basic political change, and we need to be lobbying in exactly the opposite direction toward radical energy conservation, using not just making the economic processes that we're already engaged in more efficient, but reducing the total amount of energy used in the society as a whole, year by year. And that's a tall issue because it means economic sacrifice, inevitably. But that's what we need. That's the direction we should be lobbying for. I don't think we should be lobbying for, you know, huge investments in hydrogen energy research for reasons that I discussed earlier. We'd be much better off putting that research and investment into conservation and the deployment of the renewables that we already know will work, particularly wind. Also, photovoltaic to some degree, although I'm more interested in some of the new photovoltaic technologies as opposed to the single crystal, which is more efficient in some ways, but has a lower net energy yield. Globally, we need to be striving toward energy resource cooperation. Right now, the path we're headed toward is global geopolitical energy resource competition, and that competition is not going to be just economic competition. It's going to be militarily enforced competition, and the likely results of that, given the awesome weapons of mass destruction in the hands of the U.S., particularly in other industrialized countries, likely consequences are dire beyond description. The only alternative to that is open cooperation in the conservation and allotment of the remaining energy resources. And that's not going to be easy to accomplish for lots of reasons. It's not going to seem to be in anyone's immediate self-interest to implement such a system of global energy cooperation. But ultimately, it's going to be the only thing that will save us from probably virtually the annihilation of the human race in bitter competition for what remains, not only of energy resources, but water and other basic resources over the course of the next century. I don't think that kind of cooperation is likely to happen without an immense pressure from the grassroots. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we saw between 10 and 30 million people turn out in the streets of hundreds of cities around the world to say no to war, U.S. war in Iraq. What we need is tens of millions of people turning out in the streets and exerting political pressure in other ways for a peaceful solution to the global energy crisis. And the only peaceful solution that is possible is global resource conservation and cooperation. And that's what the grassroots movements need ultimately to be promoting, not just no war in Iraq. That's a great first step. That's a great place to start. But believe me, that's only the first step also in the plans of the geopolitical strategists who are banking everything on military as the way to, you know, ensure the economic survival of any particular power such as the U.S. So I think there's some hope in the sense that there is this growing movement globally, the anti-war movement, just as the anti-war movement, I think, in many ways got its energy from and morphed out of the anti-globalization movement that had been growing during the 1990s and really emerged spectacularly in Seattle in November 1998. I think the global peace movement that's emerging from the U.S. plans to invade Iraq may itself, or should itself, merge into or morph into a global movement for global energy conservation and resource sharing between nations. Once people understand what the stakes are and what the alternatives are, I think that's the only rational course of action.
Could you just give me what you think about agriculture? And as I say, I got the impression that you were at least mentioning more vegetarianism. You mentioned effective versus efficient farming. I'll tell you why I'm asking, because so far in doing this, I haven't managed to find one person outside of EarthSave, and of course they're all about this, one person who will even countenance cutting down anything to do with flesh eating. And I speak as one who loves meat and fish, but we simply had to decide quite a long 2 or 3 years ago that it was just incompatible with offering any kind of leadership or without hypocrisy on this, so that, you know, my attitude is not that everybody has to give it all up now at all, because they won't, but rather we should be making some moves in that direction. So if you wanted to say something about that and...
Sure, I'd be happy to. I mean, I do have some personal bias in the matter because I've been a vegetarian for over 30 years now. But the fact is that our world is desperately overpopulated right now through the use of fossil fuels, particularly through the use of fossil fuels in agriculture, using the Haber-Bosch process, making ammonia-based chemical fertilizers, and by transporting foods over ever longer distances through the use of tractors and other mechanized farm machinery, we have increased the amount of food available on the planet to human beings, and as a result, the human population has increased. What we've basically done is to create what William Catton, in his fabulous book Overshoot, calls phantom carrying capacity. Up until the Industrial Revolution, up until the adoption of fossil fuels, the human population of the planet was about 1 billion people. That was the human carrying capacity of the planet. We had already pretty much put into agricultural production every place we could. Human beings were living on every continent, but we were limited by the technologies available, and the human carrying capacity that we'd arrived at was about 1 billion. But with the use of fossil fuels, for the purposes I mentioned earlier, we were able to increase that carrying capacity more than sixfold. There's 6.3 billion of us right now. Now, as fossil fuels go away, what does that mean for human population? What does that mean for our carrying capacity? It means a radical reduction in human carrying capacity, no matter how you look at it. Yes, organic forms of agriculture can be as efficient as industrial agriculture in some situations. There's no doubt about that. Personally, I'm a huge advocate of organic agriculture. 100 years from now, if there is any agriculture still going on, that is, if there are still people around, all of that agriculture will be organic because all of the fossil fuels that we've used to create industrial agriculture will be unavailable. So industrial agriculture has no future. Organic agriculture is the future, and we should be moving in that direction. However, the Haber-Bosch process by which we get our ammonia-based fertilizers produces as much nitrogen material for the biosphere, the planetary biosphere, as all of green nature produces, all the leguminous plants in the world produce, plus lightning and all the other natural sources of nitrogen. In other words, through the industrial process, the Haber-Bosch process, using fossil fuels, we have doubled the amount of available nitrogen in the biosphere. It takes a minute to really get the significance of that single statistic. What that means is once we no longer have the fossil fuels available to produce that artificial nitrogen, there is simply no way that we will be able to produce as much food as we are producing right now, no matter how clever we are with permaculture or biodynamics or biointensive gardening and all the other wonderful forms of organic agriculture that we teach our students at the school where I teach. That means that the carrying capacity for human beings is inevitably going to be reduced pretty dramatically. Best guesses from people like David Pimentel, who've done studies on this, suggest that in ideal conditions, our human carrying capacity 100 years from now might be reduced to about 2 billion humans. So how do we get from 6 billion humans to 2 billion humans without massive starvation?
That was Professor Richard Heinberg, author of The Party's Over, Oil, War, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, speaking with Julian Darley in February of last year. Heinberg is really telling us that it is beyond time to take some action, yet most people have no idea of what is even coming. The only hope for a soft landing, in fact for a society that might be a whole lot more livable in the important ways than this one, is for people to get informed and start to make arrangements within their local communities. To that end, some of us in the Finger Lakes will be meeting on Thursday, July 1st, just south of Ithaca, to try to get the ball rolling in our area. If you're interested in coming to that or future meetings on this issue, please call me, Lynn, at area code 607-535-0147. 607-535-0147. Now, anyone who thinks or hopes that the U.S. government is making arrangements to deal with this impending crisis will be disabused of this by our next speaker, Michael Clare. He's the author of Resource Wars. The talk we're about to hear was given in Athens, Ohio, shortly after the commencement of the invasion of Iraq.
I want to use my time to talk about the foreign policy and security policy consequences of the Bush administration's energy policy. This is what's known as the National Energy Policy, the NEP, which was released on May 17th, 2001, almost 2 years ago. It was prepared by a commission known as the National Energy Policy Development Group, which was headed by Dick Cheney, Vice President Dick Cheney. And so the report is often called the Cheney Report. I'll talk about the Cheney Report. Now, most of you are familiar with this report for two reasons. It generated a lot of headlines for two reasons. One reason is that most of the advice, or I should say a lot of the advice for the report came from Kenneth Lay and other leaders of the Enron Corporation, the now disgraced, defunct, bankrupt Enron Corporation, and from other oil executives and energy executives who have been accused of various malpractices. So that's one reason. The other reason, of course, is that the report advocates drilling on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, and that also has generated a lot of headlines. I think this has actually been unfortunate that this is how you would know this report. You probably know no other single thing about the report other than those two things. This is the blueprint that's governing American energy policy. It's being written into law. It has tremendous consequences. And we don't know what the rest of it is. And actually, the headlines have distracted us from the reality of what the report actually is about. The implication from the brouhaha over ANWR is that this report, this policy, is actually intended, that the purpose of the policy is to diminish America's dependence on imported oil. You keep hearing that if we drill in ANWR, we could reduce our dependence on imported oil. Nothing is further from the truth. The exact opposite is the case. The Cheney plan is a blueprint for increased American dependency on imported oil. If you read the report carefully, you find that between now and the year 2020, the United States will increase its imports of foreign oil from about 10 million barrels a day to 17 million barrels per day in 2020, an increase of 70%. If ANWR were developed, and if it has all the oil that its advocates claim it has, about 10 billion barrels, that would reduce America's imports by 5% from a 70% increase to a 65% increase. Most of the Cheney report, almost all of it, as far as it relates to oil, is how to find more oil. A 65% increase in imported oil. That's what the report is really about, and that's not what we're not hearing about. This need to increase American imports of foreign oil by 65% between now and the year 2020, and then, by the way, that's the cutoff for the report. But anybody who does these studies will know each decade the amount that we will have to import increases more after that. So it's a curve that's continually rising. This has immense foreign policy implications for the United States. Now, before I go further, let me say that when this report was conducted in the first few months of the Bush administration, we all know the United States found a profound choice, profound energy choice. Some of this was laid out for us very well this morning by John Holdren. You know, there's the business as usual model and the alternative model. So the U.S. faced a choice when the Energy Commission, the NEPDG, the National Energy Policy Development Group, met, between continuing down the road on which we are currently on, in which oil accounts for the largest share, about 40% of our energy mix, and the other fossil fuels, another 40% or so. Staying on this path means, among other things, increasing our emissions of carbon dioxide. You've heard all about that. I don't have to discuss it. But it also means increasing our dependence significantly on imported petroleum, because the United States is running out of petroleum. Alternatively, the United States could, the other choice would have been for the United States to embark on a concerted effort to move much more rapidly towards alternative energy sources, to increase our consumption of other than fossil fuels, to impose much higher requirements for fuel efficiency standards, for greater conservation, and so on. You know really the outline of the two choices. The fact that the U.S. faced such a choice was known to everybody who worked on this study, because enormous amount of intellectual work was done in the months leading up to the Cheney study. Many people who were represented at this conference contributed to those analyses. Now, if the Cheney group had any intention of weighing these choices carefully and objectively, it seems to me they would have sought equal degree of advice from proponents of business as usual and those who favor an alternative path. Instead, as we know, the NEPDG obtained 100% of its advice from proponents of the existing path and exactly zero from proponents of the alternative. We know that because under court order, the White House has released a list of who is invited to meet with the group, and no representatives of the environmental community were invited or had the opportunity to present their views. So under the circumstances, and given the proclivities of the leadership of the Bush administration, it's hardly surprising that the Cheney report is essentially an embrace of the status quo, the current path of continued dependence on petroleum. Now, bear in mind that our use of petroleum is not level. Our population is rising. We are driving our vehicles more frequently. Our economic activity is increasing. Moreover, all of the construction, almost virtually all of the construction of new housing in the United States, if you look at the census data, I'm sure most of you are aware of that. I just flew into Columbus. Fly into any American city and you see the same thing. All the new housing is outside the beltway. It's further and further and further away from jobs in central cities. So the average commute and the average drive to your school, your church, to the nearest store for all Americans is increasing. So over the next 20 years, our need for petroleum is expected to increase by 40%. It's not a level. So the Cheney plan calls not just for satisfying our current petroleum needs, but to increase our supply of petroleum by 40% between now and 2020. That's what the report is aimed at, how to sustain our addiction to our current level of use of petroleum. And as I say, this will require more imported oil. Where is this oil going to come from? That's what I want to talk about now, because I think that's what matters. The question is more where is it going to come from than whether the supply is somewhat more optimistic or somewhat less optimistic than we've been hearing. One thing we know, it's not going to come from the United States. This increase will not come from the United States. We know that because the existing fields in this country are in decline. As we've seen, they began declining in the early 1970s. And even if ANWR is developed, this will have no effect on the long-term pattern of declining U.S. production. In fact, ANWR would do is reduce the speed of the decline in American production. It won't add anything new to American production. It will just reduce the downside, the decline of American production. So where is it going to come from? This extra oil, 7 million barrels per day, is going to have to come from outside the United States. But this is the real question. Where outside the United States is this going to come from? This question should send shivers down the back of every American, especially if you're a young person or you, like me, have a teenage child or preteen children, or you're worried about terrorism. This question is absolutely vital to your life. This is so for a very simple reason. Virtually all of the oil that we're going to depend on in the years ahead is going to come from countries that are unstable, are ruled by authoritarian regimes, are at war, or are unfriendly to the United States, or some combination of all four of those. This is true because one of the great ironies of modern human history, I don't know, whatever you believe in, Mother Nature, or some god, or cosmic roll of the dice, the United States was given the first large supply of oil, the first large supply of oil to be discovered, and that jump-started our industrial economy, produced the first large international corporations, as Jeffrey Kemp indicated, assured our success in World War I and World War II, and allowed us to develop an economy and a way of life based on the automobile, suburbs, and all of that implies. But we weren't given enough oil, we weren't endowed with enough oil to live this way indefinitely. And most of the rest of the world's oil is in Africa, the Middle East, the Caucasus region, and the Andes. That's where the rest of it is located. And more significantly, the oil that we have used up until now, as Jeffrey Kemp indicated, 70% of our oil currently comes from the Americas. All of these fields were discovered long ago. You saw the chart that Kenneth DeFraise showed us of when the peak discoveries in the United States were in the 1930s. That's largely true for Canada and Mexico and Venezuela as well. These were the first large fields to be discovered, and they're the first large fields to reach peak production and decline. The North Sea is the only other major source of oil in the what you might call the safe areas in the industrial world, and that too is in decline. So as you go into the future, all of the sources that we've relied on are in decline. More and more we have to go to the rest of the world. I have some figures here. I don't want to bore you with a great deal of them. In the year 2000, about 33%, about a third of world oil production came from the United States, North America, the North Sea, and Russia, while the Middle East provided less, 30% of world production, Africa about 10%. But because these older fields are in decline and we're becoming more dependent on these other areas, in the year 2025 now, this is the most recent Department of Energy figures, the industrialized countries, North America, Europe, and Russia, their supply of world production will drop considerably from a third, 33%, to 21%. At the same time, the Middle East will rise to 35% of world production and Africa to 15%. So all told, the developing world in the year 2025 will account for about 77% of all world production, and that percentage will keep increasing, with the Middle East and Africa taking at least half of the total. The trends are very clear. The further we go into the future, the more our automobilized lifestyle will depend on our ability to acquire oil from unstable and hostile areas in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America, and the Caspian. Now, obviously, these countries have economic incentives to sell us their oil, and most will choose to do so most of the time, and in some cases, they might even be able to ensure that these supplies are delivered, although that's not always clear. But if current trends are any indication, well, that will not be sufficiently reliable. Market forces will not be sufficiently reliable to ensure us that we can rely on those sources of oil. Right now, production in Venezuela is down by half because of internal disorders in that country. Production in Nigeria is dropped to half or less because of internal disorders in that country. Iraq is at war. Iran and Libya are subject to economic sanctions of one sort or another because of their support of terrorism and illicit proliferation. Georgia, the most important pipeline route for Caspian oil, is beset not by one but by four ethnic conflicts. And Colombia, another major supplier to the United States, is at war. This is the condition today. Do we have any reason to assume that conditions in these areas will be any better in 2020 or 2025? I have no reason to think that we could have any confidence in that. So what matters is not the total amount of oil, but where it's going to come from and the political conditions in those areas. And I think anybody with any analytical ability could see that we're depending on areas that are highly unstable and dangerous, so that we're depending for our survival of our way of life on highly unstable areas. What is the solution to that? Well, one solution, of course, is to consume less petroleum. The other is to try to solve the problem through the application of military force. And that is the choice that has been made by the Bush administration. But I don't want to indicate that it's only the Bush administration. This has been the policy of every American administration since Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It's just intensifying. And I want to make clear, it was Bill Clinton who viewed the Caspian Sea as a national security interest of the United States and built up the military capacity that we relied on after 9/11. So it's not just the Bush administration. But the Bush administration, I think, has moved us either further in this direction. And so what's happened is that increasingly our energy policy is becoming our military policy. For example, today we have military instructors in Colombia who are essentially taking over responsibility for the protection of the Caño Limón pipeline that brings Occidental Petroleum's fuel to the coast for export to the United States. Drugs have dropped off the agenda as the leading concern. We have troops in Georgia that are training the troops to protect the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline, the main route for Caspian Sea oil. We're building bases in Kazakhstan and the oil fields to protect the oil there. And of course, we have troops protecting the oil fields in Iraq. And I suspect they're going to be there for a very long time to come. In fact, we cannot envision when they're going to leave Iraq. I mean, under present conditions, we should have no reasonable expectation that they will leave in any imaginable length of time. Now, I don't want to try to argue that the invasion of Iraq is solely about oil. Jeffrey Kemp has argued persuasively that we have to worry about weapons of mass destruction and other considerations, and a policy as complicated as this is always the basis of many considerations. But I don't think we can say that the invasion of Iraq would have occurred if it weren't for this history and this backdrop of its Vice President Dick Cheney, who wrote the energy policy, its Vice President Dick Cheney, who has been the leading advocate for the war in Iraq at the highest levels of the administration. And I think there is no question that there is a connection between the two. So I think that what we see now is only a foretaste of what we could expect, that increasingly our military policy will be dictated by our energy policy. I can't use up huge amount of time to detail to you the military policy of the Bush administration. But if you read it carefully, you'll see that it fits perfectly with the energy policy. Probably you're under the impression that the most significant feature in the Bush military strategy is an emphasis on high-tech weapons, precision-guided weapons. That's not accurate. That's an important part, but the single most important part of the Bush military policy is an emphasis on what the military calls power projection. That is the ability to deploy military force from the United States or bases like in Britain and Japan to remote areas of the world, to carry in paratroopers, aircraft carriers, amphibious assault fleets. It means lightening up the lightening the Army and Marines so that they could be moved very quickly by plane and by ship to areas of instability that don't have large bases. It's power projection that's the primary objective of the Bush. Enhanced power projection is the primary strategic objective of the Bush military plan and where most of the money is going to be spent. As well, the war against terrorism has become a war to protect American oil. And this is not just a matter of rhetoric. It's because terrorism and oil go together in many cases. Oil tends to favor the rise of totalitarian or authoritarian regimes where one family or one tribe or one clique or one party could be the Ba'ath Party, it could be the House of Saud, it could be a particular ethnic group, dominates the nation and uses the oil revenue to enrich itself and to keep itself in power by paying for the police and military. You could be talking about Nigeria, you could be talking about Venezuela, you could be talking about Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia. All of these countries have a similar characteristic. And this leads opposition groups who resent the maldistribution of the nation's oil wealth to revolt, often by attacking the oil fields and the oil pipelines. So Nigeria is now shut down as an oil producer because of attacks on oil production in the Delta region, which is where the oil comes from, but all of the money goes to the central government, none of it to the people of the Delta region. In Colombia, the guerrillas attacked the pipelines. The leading, most classic example is probably 9/11. 9/11 is essentially a reflection of the war between Osama bin Laden and the Saudi royal family, attacking the royal family for its corruption. Its corruption is because of its waste of the Arab people's oil on palaces, corruption because of its ties to the United States. The United States is tied to the royal family to protect the oil. Therefore, we have a commitment to protect the royal family. This goes back to FDR. The purpose of September 11th was to destroy the alliance between the U.S. and the Saudi royal family. And one might say that it's moving and it might prove successful in the end. That was its ultimate goal. So terrorism and oil production are linked, and it follows that anti-terrorism and oil are equally linked, and indeed America's war against terrorism is becoming a war to protect the flow of oil from the Caspian, from Latin America, and I assume eventually from Africa. So in conclusion, it seems to me the results of all of this are inescapable. By making the choice to satisfy America's addiction to cheap and plentiful petroleum through increasing reliance on supplies acquired from unstable and unfriendly and totalitarian regimes in the developing world, the Bush administration has condemned this country, but I need to emphasize the Bush administration didn't start this policy, it's just accelerating the policy of militarizing our energy policy, condemning us to an unending involvement in conflict and violence in oil-producing areas of the developing world. Is this the best choice for America? I think we all have to face that ourselves and examine our soul. This is an ethical question, a moral question in my mind, because it entails the use of violence to protect our lifestyle. To my mind, that's a deeply ethical question. We all have to think about this and debate it and reach our conclusion. But I'll say for myself, I've made up my mind. I believe that this choice, the militarization of American energy policy, is dangerous, it's irresponsible, it's un-American, and it's fundamentally immoral, and I think we should reject it.
That was Professor Michael Clare speaking in April 2003 at the Ohio University Baker Peace Conference on Energy Consumption and the Environment. Thanks to Julian Darley, whose material comprised the program this week. Julian Darley has also founded an organization, the Post Carbon Institute, to help people in local communities inform themselves and initiate action to prepare for life in a low-energy world. Check out his website at postcarbon.org, postcarbon.org. And to send email to this show or download previous shows you've missed, visit us on the web at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.